Virginia Tech is quiet this morning after a gunman shot and killed a campus police officer and then killed himself yesterday afternoon. For hours, the sprawling campus in Blacksburg, Virginia, relived the horror of a 2007 shooting that left 33 dead and raised troubling questions about the university's slow response to the tragedy. As NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports, this time Virginia Tech was prepared.
According to Virginia State Police, here's how Thursday's shooting on the Virginia Tech campus unfolded. At about 12 noon, Officer Derek Krause had pulled over to call in a traffic violation. Minutes later, witnesses say a man walked from out of a nearby parking lot and shot Krause while he was sitting in his car. The gunman fled on foot. Gene Deisinger is Virginia Tech's Deputy Chief of Police.
Shortly before 12:30 p.m., Virginia Tech Police received its first call advising that they had witnessed a subject approach the officer and fire a weapon at the officer and then leave the scene.
Across campus, Carolyn Crow, a freshman, was in the library. Classes were not in session. Students had the entire day to study and prepare for finals. At 12:46, Crow's cell phone beeped. It was a text message from the university's advanced security alert system. It read, "Gunshots reported."
And then I got one at 12:56 saying, describing the suspect. I got another one at 1:30 saying a police officer has been shot. I got another one at 2:31.
At another one at 3:14, followed by another at 4:46.
Saying that it's no longer an active threat and that your lockdown's over.
Students across campus got text messages, emails, and updates on the school's homepage, ordering students to stay indoors, away from windows. Shortly before 5 p.m., police announced that the search for the gunman was over. He had apparently shot and killed himself. Also dead was Officer Krause, 39, an Army veteran and father of five, Virginia Tech President Charles Steger.
Our hearts are broken again for the family of our police officer, and we extend our deepest sympathy and condolences.
Neither Steger nor police investigators would confirm the identity of the gunman, describing him only as a white male. Nor would they confirm that the man found dead and the gunman were one and the same. But by late Thursday night, heavily armed officers and SWAT teams that were on campus were gone, evidently satisfied that there was no longer a threat. Ironically, the shooting took place right around the time that Virginia Tech officials were in Washington appealing a $55,000 government penalty for the university's slow response to the 2007 shootings that left 33 dead. Darryl Wilkinson, a freshman, wasn't here in 2007, but in a way, he says, he feels reassured that this time Virginia Tech did all it could to keep students safe and informed.
This was a fairly isolated incident. There was, unfortunately, one death, but that's better than 32.
Virginia Tech has suspended finals for now. A student vigil is scheduled for this evening on campus, and police say their investigation will continue into the identity and motives of the shooter. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News, Blacksburg, Virginia.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Public libraries are working to redefine their roles and stay relevant in this digital information age. A small number are working to create something called hacker spaces where people share sophisticated tools and expertise. John Kalish has the story.
Libraries have long made computers and internet access available to the public. And in recent years, dispensing information has also meant providing e-books and other technologies that the founders of the first public libraries could never have imagined. Now, public libraries are experimenting with workplaces known as hackerspaces. The Allen County Public Library, which serves the city of Fort Wayne, Indiana, has a modest hackerspace inside a trailer in its parking lot. Library Director Jeff Kroll says hosting it is consistent with the library's mission.
We see the library as not being in the book business, but being in the learning business and the exploration business and the expand your mind business. And we feel this is really in that spirit, that we provide a resource to the community that individuals would not be able to have access to on their own.
The 50-foot trailer is known as the Maker Station and belongs to TechVenture, an educational nonprofit that had struggled to find a building it could afford before it was approached by the library. TechVenture signed an agreement with the library to operate in its parking lot for a year. TechVenture president Greg Jacobs says this partnership makes sense.
The library is a well-established, respectable institution in the area. The library is used by everybody, regardless of your stripe in society. You're going to use library facilities.
And now those facilities include a CNC router, a computer-controlled power tool that cuts wood, plastic, and some metals. The Maker Station also has a lathe, scroll and bandsaws, an electronics bench, and an injection molding machine which makes objects by heating up recycled plastic chips. And like any hackerspace worth its salt, they have a 3D printer, which can produce plastic objects based on a computer file. In recent years, there's been some chatter on the librarian blogs about the rise of 3D printing. Meg Backus has a blog about interventionist librarianship and teaches a course at Syracuse University called Innovations in Public Libraries.
People in the library world have noticed that 3D printers would be a fit for libraries, or that libraries should be paying attention to this technology and how it develops, because this could be a really big deal. I'd be completely surprised if we don't all have 3D printers in 20 years.
There's already a 3D printer donated by a local computer store in the Fayetteville Free Library in upstate New York. Not only that, the library was recently awarded $10,000 for the creation of a hackerspace. 29-year-old librarian Lauren Smedley is responsible for winning the grant and raising $3,500 in pledges for the hackerspace on the website Indiegogo. Smedley walks a visitor into an unoccupied wing of her library with 10-foot-high ceilings. She explains that this was once the home of the Stickley Furniture Factory.
People used to make things in this very room, and we're going to offer this community the opportunity to once again make things here. And it's just a thrill. It's really exciting.
Smedley is calling the Fayetteville Hackerspace the Fabulous Laboratory. It'll have about 8,000 square feet and be equipped with a number of sophisticated computer-controlled power tools. This fabulous laboratory may not seem out of place in a library that has a cafe, video gaming stations, iPads available for checkout, and regular author appearances via Skype.
I really envision this space being a place for people to come and tinker and explore. We're really looking to have a peer-to-peer training that has proven effective in maker spaces really across the world, with some facilitation from the library staff. You know, it's really whatever the community wants to use it for is how we'll support it.
The library is expecting a grant from the state of New York to renovate the wing for the hackerspace and a business incubation center. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today, we're taking an extended look at education. In a few minutes, we'll talk about school choice and one initially hopeful parent's view that charter schools aren't measuring up to the hype. And a little later in the program, we'll talk about why some students are not staying the course when it comes to finishing college, and if there's something the adults who love them can do about that. That's all coming up. But we want to begin today by checking in with one of this country's most high-profile and provocative educators, Michelle Rhee. The former chancellor of D.C.'s public schools, she left after a tumultuous three-year term there to found the national organization Students First, which pushes an aggressive reform and agenda that it claims would give America, quote, the best education system in the world, unquote. That's a bold promise from a leader with a reputation for boldness. In her stint as leader of D.C.'s public school, she became a national symbol of a take-no-prisoners approach to fixing public education. She was credited with raising student achievement in the nation's capital, but she was also accused of having a divisive approach that vilified career teachers and shut out parents. And currently, questions about possible cheating on standardized tests have threatened her legacy in Washington, but she remains a leading voice in the education debate. Students First marks its first year this month, so we thought this would be a good time to check back in with her. Michelle Rhee, welcome back to the program. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on the first anniversary.
Thank you. It's been a great year.
Well, you know, you have always been one for benchmarks. So I wanted to ask you, what benchmarks have you accomplished this year?
Well, we set about starting Students First about a year ago and said that within the first year we wanted to have 1 million members, and we are closely approaching that mark. So we feel very, very good about the fact that we are going to meet that goal. And second is just what our members have been able to do. In 7 states across the country, we have enacted more than 50 laws that we really believe set the groundwork and the foundation for the children in those states getting a much, much higher quality education. So we're pleased with what our members have been able to do on that front.
Give an example of one of those laws that you feel is the kind of thing you'd like to see emulated as far-reaching as possible.
Sure. So this is actually one policy is something that we first put in place in Washington, D.C., and it is putting an end to the policy called last in, first out, which mandates that in the time of layoffs, because of a budget cut, that you have to lay off the least senior teacher or the last person hired must be the first person fired, regardless of performance. We have seen through research and data that this policy has incredibly detrimental impacts on children. It really ensures that you are getting rid of some of your most highly effective teachers, number one. Number two, it necessitates the need to disrupt even more classrooms and fire more teachers because the least junior teacher or the most junior teachers are the least paid. And lastly, and probably most importantly, is that it disproportionately negatively impacts the lowest performing schools in the city because those are the schools that usually have the largest number of new teachers. So when we got started at the beginning of 2010, there were only 3 states across the nation that prohibited seniority-based layoffs, and our hope was to triple that number. And now we do have 11 states across the country who say that when in the time of layoffs, you have to do those layoffs by quality and effectiveness as opposed to seniority.
You know, to that end, your critics here in Washington and around the country say that this focus on ending the seniority system for teachers actually diminishes respect for career educators. There are those who would argue, you know, that at the end of the day, it almost as if the more seniority you have, the more you're perceived as an enemy of reform. It's almost like as if respect for people diminishes as they advance in their profession, which is different from the way it tends to work in other fields of endeavor. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think the way that it works in other fields is that the people who are respected, who are compensated, are the people who are most effective in the field. So if you're looking for a doctor for your child, for example, you aren't saying, well, who has been a doctor the longest? You're looking for the person who has the best track record, who has, who has ensured that that of the surgeries they've performed, that the vast majority of them, if not all of them, have been successful. That's what we look for in a doctor as parents. And that's the same thing that we should be looking for in our educators. I think that
doesn't experience have something to do with that? I mean, it's my understanding just on the medical profession alone that there tends to be a U-curve, that people who are just out, who've been exposed to the latest research and the latest innovative ideas, highly effective very often, even if they lack practical experience, and people who have the most experience because they have that mixture of experience and real-world experience. I mean, isn't it both?
Well, actually, that's why you do have incredibly highly effective teachers who have been teaching, 30, sometimes 35 years in the system. And you have highly effective teachers who've maybe only been teaching 5 years in the system. So you have highly effective teachers at every point along the spectrum. And that's why we think that it's so important to ensure that that's what we're prioritizing, is how effective is a teacher as opposed to how long they've been teaching. Because there are certainly some teachers, unfortunately, who have been in the system for a long time who are not effective. And for those folks, it's important to ensure that just because they've been there longer doesn't mean that they should have the right to have a job over somebody who may have been teaching a few years less than they do but are much more effective with kids. And I think at the end of the day, we have to raise the profile and the respect level of the teaching profession. And in order to do that, we have to understand that not all teachers are interchangeable widgets, that they're not all the same, and the only thing that differs between them is how many years they've been in the system. We all as parents know that there are incredible differences between educators, and that when your child has a highly effective teacher, it makes all the difference in the world. So I think that in order to really respect teachers for the professionals that they are, we have to understand that there are big differences between people.
I'm speaking with education reformer Michelle Rhee. It's the one-year anniversary that was observed this month of her organization, Students First. We're talking about what she's accomplished in that time, what she hopes yet to do. But to that end, on this whole question of how you measure teacher effectiveness, obviously test scores play a role in that. And now the U.S. Department of Education and the D.C. Inspector General are investigating questions of cheating on standardized tests taken by city students during your tenure. Now, you've said you welcome the investigation because that's exactly Absolutely. The kind of thing that's necessary to demonstrate belief and to further belief in the system. But given that there are other school systems like Atlanta that do seem to have uncovered credible evidence of cheating, mm-hmm. Number one, how can you be so sure? And number two, why might not that be a sign that the incentives to cheat are just too great when you put that much focus on test scores?
Yeah. So, here's the thing. I think that I have a tremendous amount of faith in the educators in this country. And I believe very, very strongly that the vast majority of professionals would never compromise their personal professional integrity and cheat on a test. Unfortunately, you're going to have a small number or an individual here and there who make the wrong decision. Those people should have significant consequences that are attached to that. But I don't think that we should say because some people have made the wrong decision, we should get rid of the accountability system first and foremost. And second of all, if you look at D.C., we had a teacher evaluation system which did count test scores as part of a teacher's evaluation, but it was part of a holistic picture. We also looked at their observations of their classroom practice, their contributions to the school community. So if you had bad test scores alone, you actually couldn't be fired based on that, just based on those poor test scores. Because if you were doing other things right, then you would still be rated as effective. However, if you decided to cheat on a test and we uncovered evidence that you did, you would immediately lose your job. So I think that if it was somebody who was thinking critically about their job security, then you would make the decision not to cheat on the test and to do right by kids.
Yeah. And lastly, before we let you go, I did want to talk about charter schools. And I do think it's important to emphasize that because you're so identified with education reform, I think sometimes people get confused and think that you led the charter schools in Washington, D.C., when in fact it was the opposite. You led right. the public school system, which I think it's fair to say was actually competing with the charter school system in D.C., which is quite, robust. I just want to just yes. clarify that for people who don't remember. And I do want to mention that later in the program, we're going to speak to a mother who says that school choice and public charter schools are not living up to the promise that she had hoped, especially for parents in working class neighborhoods. Before we let you go, we have a couple of minutes left. I did want to ask you about what role you think public charter schools are playing now in achieving educational excellence, given that the data seems to be very mixed on whether they are achieving better results than traditional public schools.
Well, I think that, at least from my perspective, charter schools were never meant to be the end-all, be-all, the panacea of the woes of public education. I think that we should be looking not at whether a school is a charter school or a traditional public school or a private school, but rather, is it an effective school? And I think what the charter school movement has shown is that when you can free up a school and a group of educators from the bureaucracy, that it is possible for them to develop schools that significantly outperform the public school district, that take low-income and minority children who previously had been performing at incredibly low levels and lift them to the highest levels possible. Does that mean that every single charter school is going to be effective? No. Just like every single traditional public school is not necessarily effective in every school district either. That's why I think the important thing is to look at every single school individually, and then to, in the case of charter schools, if there are ineffective charter schools, it's important to shut those schools down, because part of the idea around charter schools to begin with was that you would have increased authority and autonomy in exchange for increased accountability. And if the school was not doing well, that school would lose its charter and it would not be able to serve kids anymore.
Michelle Rhee is the founder and president of Students First. That's a national organization dedicated to fostering excellence in American public education. She joined us from Sacramento, California. I do hope we'll speak again, Michelle Rhee. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, eating, activism, and art. We will speak with a man who has had success by combining all three here in the nation's capital, restaurateur Andy Shalal. We'll have that conversation in a few minutes. But first, we have another perspective on education reform, specifically the idea of school choice. Now, many people think of school choice as about allowing kids to attend private schools with public funds. But another option is charter schools, and those have grown dramatically over the past decade. According to the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools, more than 2 million children currently attend about 5,600 charter schools in the U.S. And President Obama's Race to the Top education program provides public support to some charters deemed high-performing. But not everybody thinks these schools are serving kids the best way possible. One of those critics is Natalie Hopkinson, a contributing editor for TheRoot.com. Her opinion piece, Why School Choice Fails, was published in the New York Times this month. She has two children attending schools in the Washington, D.C. area, one in a charter school and one in a private school. And Natalie Hopkinson joins us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
What would cause you to try to navigate the public schools in this way, or the public-private charter dilemma in this way? What wasn't working?
Well, you have first of all, our first choice would have been to really invest in our neighborhood school. And we live in, an inner city community near Howard University. And that would have been our first choice. But we quickly got indications from the administration there that, I was told that these kids have problems, and explore your options. So that was my introduction to choice when my son was just 6 months old and in a stroller. So we've been on this journey. We've been to traditional DCPS schools. We have been to parochial
meaning DC
schools.
Public schools.
DC traditional neighborhood public schools that are high performing. We've been to parochial schools. And now my eldest is in middle school age. And so I feel that this is really where the cliff begins, because there's so much excitement, and I'm sure there are a lot of parents who right now are going through it's really actually exciting. You apply to, you go to like 10 open houses, you get on a million waiting lists, and you see what happens, and maybe you make it through elementary school, and then there's this cliff, and that's middle school.
So what your specific beefs about charter schools are that, there's a lot of hype and excitement about mm-hmm. them, but you're saying not only do they not live up to the hype, but in fact, you see in some ways they're actually detrimental. Several things that you say. You write, on the one hand, you say that they've destroyed community-based education for working-class families. Number two, you think that they lead to resegregation, and that they consistently perform worse than traditional schools, yet are rarely closed. Now, I'm going to dispute your facts on the last one, which is that the National Alliance for Public School Charters reports that here in D.C., four new charters were opened last year, and three were shut down. And I also think that the evidence shows that the charters consistently perform better in some grades and worse in others, so that it's mixed. But let's talk about those other two, that they, in fact, contribute, in your view, to the destruction of traditional neighborhood public schools, and that they lead to resegregation. How so? What's your evidence?
Well, basically the whole structure is an experimental structure. So you open up a school, it doesn't work, you close it down. That child has had to readjust to, two, three different school settings. And that's not healthy for anyone. And there's really the main issue that I was getting at in the New York Times piece was we have lost an entitlement to a neighborhood education that some people in the city have and we don't. And so if you're talking about public education, you're talking about, well, what do you have access to? What are you entitled to have? As a resident of Ward 5, I am not entitled to a middle school, period. I must sign up for a lottery. So I have a problem with the experimental nature of it and the sort of like trial and error, like, oops, okay, sort of the attitude is, well, these kids are at, you know, those kids are at risk, and what's a few more risk for them? And I don't think that's acceptable.
So a year is a long time in a child's life. So moving a kid from school to school to school year after year, you think that might sound fine on paper, but in actual reality, it's just not great.
I don't think it's even fine on paper. I mean, there's no stability. There's no foundation for us to build on. And, you know, I feel like all these years in, you know, looking back, you've been choosing, and you've been disinvesting in your own community. And there's nothing for everyone. There's no ground for everyone to stand on.
So there's no floor.
Well,
you know, it seems to me that the core of your argument is that it goes back to the basic argument around school choices, which is, on the one hand, you say, well, the whole point of school choice is to expand choices, but it really doesn't. It just rearranges the deck chairs. Is that the investment and the excitement and the hype and all the innovation flows to the new thing,
exactly,
and that the old thing is left to wither on the vine. Do I have that right?
Absolutely.
But there are those who would argue that you're romanticizing the traditional public schools. For a lot of people, traditional public schools dating back generations have been a nightmare. And the only difference was that working class kids didn't have any choice, even on paper. What would your argument be to that? What would your response be to that?
Well, and you know, and that's sort of the boogeyman that you get. Well, then, you know, maybe some communities shouldn't get traditional neighborhood schools because, you know, kids have struggled on a test at one point. I mean, you're talking about disinvestment in certain communities that will last for generations. Once you take the building away, it's gone forever, and there's nothing you can do about it. I'm not seeing them improving any new traditional neighborhood schools. I see them opening up new charter schools, which, again, I'm not against charters at all. And actually, my argument is not against charters. It's against the whole choice-based, like the idea that we're just going to choose our way out of this mess.
When you where you are now, as you sit here now, and you've got your kids in two schools, and I hope they're doing well, or at least okay enough, mm-hmm, that you feel okay about life. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about what's down the line for you?
For me personally, you know, my husband and I have really good jobs. We're very educated. We have really all the choices that any middle-class person has in the city. We could move to Columbia, Maryland if we had choose to. We could move to Ward 3 if we choose to.
Columbia, Maryland being a suburb, Ward 3 being an affluent part of the Washington,
yes,
D.C. of Washington, D.C.
Yeah, so I'm not so much worried about us, because whatever we have to do to get our kids through and make sure that they stay on the right path, we're going to do. What I'm really concerned about is that this sort of idea that some kids deserve this and some kids don't deserve that because they're bad anyway. You know, like this is what I have the problem with.
Natalie Hopkinson is a mother of two in the Washington, D.C. area. She's a contributing editor for The Root. That's an online publication that focuses on issues of particular interest to African Americans. We were talking about a piece that she wrote called Why School Choice Fails for the New York Times. And she was nice enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios to talk about it. Natalie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again.